If you've ever watched musicals or enjoy musicals, either movies or Broadway shows, there's often in the musical the scene where the romance happens, where the one person declares the love for the other. Maybe they're speaking to one another, or maybe they're singing off in separate places, talking about the values of love and what love looks like. And one of the musicals that I enjoy, now I'm not giving it a full-on recommendation here, so be careful, is the 2001 movie version of Moulin Rouge. Moulin Rouge is a story of a young bohemian poet back set in the like late 19th century, a young bohemian poet named Christian and his love for the singer in this nightclub named Satine. And one of my favorite things about Moulin Rouge is the way they incorporate a lot of pop songs in the course of this show. And there's a scene where Christian comes to Satine to declare his love, to try and convince her they should be together. And he begins the scene by saying, "Love lifts us up where we belong, and all you need is love." And to which she responds, "Oh, please don't start that again." And then he breaks into this medley of love songs from the 60s, the 70s, and 80s, talking about all you need is love, and I was made for loving you, baby, and in the name of love, and speaking of silly love songs, and love lifts us up where we belong, and I will always love you. And there's several others, and he gets in this thing. And songs are a way we express love. We seek to describe it, and often primarily in romantic ways. And you're saying, what has this got to do with anything right now? Well, as you read 1 Corinthians 13, it almost feels like a love song, doesn't it? It has this musical cadence to it, this poetry to it. And if we've been around church for a while, even if you've been to weddings, you've probably heard this read at a wedding. Now, it was certainly not the original context for it. It wasn't written as a song about a love between a man and a woman. In fact, it was written to some people not in love, but probably didn't even love each other or even like each other very much. It was written by a man named Paul to a church in the city of Corinth. And in this city of Corinth, there was a small church that Paul had started, and there were divisions in the church, there were fights within the church, there were squabbles within the church, and they revolved around a lot of issues, but primarily there were two groups of people, and the one group of people thought of themselves as particularly special. They thought of themselves as wise, as knowledgeable, and they tended to look down on the others. They tended to think of themselves before the others. And this also happened in terms of something called spiritual gifts or gifts of the Spirit, which is talked about in chapter 12, the chapter immediately preceding this, where it's talking about how God gifts individuals within the church and gives them gifts, abilities, talents for the good of the body. And some of these gifts are more prominent. Some of these gifts are more visible. There were gifts of tongues where people could speak potentially in an unknown language or maybe speaking in a language that they didn't know previously. There were gifts of prophecy where someone would have a particular utterance, maybe a vision of the future, maybe a word for the people. There were gifts of healing, and there were people seeking these gifts, and oftentimes they wanted those gifts that were showy, the gifts that kind of demonstrated power. And when they had those gifts, they looked down at the people who had maybe gifts of service or gifts of humility and look down on them. And so they're struggling and this issue is happening. And so Paul wants to show them that these gifts can enhance the community instead of dividing it. Because that was what was happening, was as people had different gifts, it caused division in the community instead of building it up. And so he's moving into this and he's saying the only way the gifts can enhance the community is if they're based in love. That love is essential for the use of the gifts, but more than that, it's a foundation for everything in the community. It's the essential component, the sine qua non. It's everything that the community needs to live. It's the essential part of it. And so as he launches into this, we want to keep that in mind. This is what he's talking about, is a community needs love. But before we get to that, I want to go to another book of the Bible, and I want us to think about where love comes from and what love looks like. And so this is in another book of our New Testament called 1 John. It's a letter from John to the community there. And so in chapter 4 of 1 John, this is what he says. He says, "Dear friends, let us love one another, for love comes from God." So what's the source of love? Love for is God. Everyone who loves has been born of God and knows God. Whoever does not love does not know God, because God is love. This is how God showed his love among us. And so then he goes on to say, this is what love looks like. He sent his one and only Son, that is Jesus, into the world that we might live through him. And this is love. Not that we loved God, but that he loved us and sent his Son as an atoning sacrifice for our sins. Dear friends, since God so loved us, we also ought to love one another. So what's the basis of our love? God's love for us. And he says, no one has ever seen God, but if we love one another, God lives in us and his love is made complete in us. So when we love others, it's the completion of God's love in us. In other words, when we're loving, it's God's love going through us. So have that in mind as we look to this. And so what do we think about first when Paul says about love? He starts it this way. And he says, if I speak in the tongues of men or of angels but do not have love, I am only a resounding gong or a clanging cymbal. And it's this sort of conditional statement. If I were to speak but didn't have love, it would be nothing. If I have the gift of prophecy and can fathom all mysteries and all knowledge, and if I have a faith that can move mountains but do not have love, I am nothing. If I give all I possess to the poor and give my body to hardship that I may boast, but do not love, I gain nothing. So he goes on and he talks about these different things. First, he speaks of in tongues of angels. And so there's a lot of debate about exactly what that means. And that's regardless of how we understand it. He says, if you don't have love when you're speaking in tongues, it's a reverberating jar. It's just a gong. Or as one writer put it, I liked, he says, it's just intrusive decibels. In other words, it's just noise. I mean, you can think of like, oh, tongues of angels. Even if we don't know what that means, does that sound something beautiful or something ugly? It sounds like something beautiful. He says, but without love, it's just a gong. It's just pots clanging. And one writer, I like the way he put it, he says, in fact, spiritual giftedness of any kind without love is painful for others to experience. And so you get this sense of like, if we don't have love, it's actually painful to use a gift. He goes on about faith and about knowledge. And he says, without love, they're nothing. He doesn't say, well, without love, they're not as effective. Without love, they're maybe not quite as good. But in fact, without love, nothing. He says you can have possessed to the, he talks about faith and the knowledge. He says everything, the correct theology, immense sight, no love, nothing. He says you can sacrifice everything. You can give away all you have to the poor, but everything must come from love. We think, well, how else can we give? Well, we can give out of half-resented duty. What Rhonda was saying, what, you have to or you get to, right? Sometimes we give up because we have, well, I've got to do this. I'm supposed to serve the poor, so I'm going to do it. Or maybe we do it because we think we can gain approval from God. But he says, if you're not doing it with love, then it's nothing. Love is the way we use our gifts. It's the MO, it's the modus operandi for exercising our gifts. So any gift practiced without love is what? Nothing. And then he goes on to talk about what love looks like. And I know I've told this story before, but it's always served as a helpful illustration to me. And the way I begin the story off it is thinking of when some of my oldest children, we were visiting the orthodontist when we lived up in Sheboygan. And we had gone to the orthodontist and they'd gotten one of their first appliances in their mouth. And if you've ever had orthodontistry, an expander, retainer plate, whatever, one of the troubles you have with it is speaking, right? It's trouble. Your tongue doesn't work quite like it is. And so the orthodontist looked at my daughter and said, I want you to say this after me. And he said, I love lollipops. My daughter looked at him and said, I like lollipops. And he said, I love lollipops. And she said, well, I like lollipops. And he looked at her again. He says, I love, she said, I like. And I had to stop. I said, okay, well, this is something we've taught our children. I said that when we use the word love, we use the word love and it's exclusively maintained for talking about God or people. We don't talk about loving other things. And it was kind of say the importance and the value of love. But even as I was reflecting on this passage this week, I think
I didn't fully think through all the implications of, but I want us to think about it in the terms of how we often use it, for example, related to food. And we talk about, I love something. And so, for example, I might say, I love pizza. And so, what do I mean when I say, I love pizza? I desire it, I crave it, I want it. What benefit does my love of pizza give the pizza? I know, go with me here for a minute, but I mean, does the pizza gain anything from my love? No, it's devoured. And think about that kind of love. That love is purely about what I want, what I need, what my desires are. So now if we transfer that same kind of love can often translate into what we call love for people, where it's not really about the other person, it's about fulfilling my wants, fulfilling my desires, fulfilling my needs. It's self-consent, self-centered and concerned with my pleasure. And so when we often use that word love, that's what it means. But Paul wants us to understand it differently. And don't worry now, I'm not going to police you down in the cafeteria or in the gym afterwards, and if you grab a cookie, say, oh, I love these cookies. Don't use that word. But I want us to think about, and I want us to hope to see how love comes across as being something about benefiting me and bringing status and pleasure, and how Paul frames it differently and how he describes it. So let's hear again these words that John read a little bit earlier. He says, love is patient. Love is kind. It does not envy. It does not boast. It is not proud. And I think a number of commentators suggest that we want to read these as more active. And so maybe we would say, love waits patiently. Love performs acts of kindness. Love does not burn with envy. Love does not brag. It is not inflated with itself. It is, or its own importance. And so it's not simply a descriptor. It's the way that love acts and behaves. It does not dishonor others. It is not self-seeking. It is not easily angered. It keeps no record of wrongs. Love does not delight in evil, but rejoices with the truth. It always protects, always trusts, always hopes, always perseveres. And as we think about those descriptions, I've seen some suggest that one way to think about those words is to substitute in where it says love is, to substitute Jesus is or God is. So in other words, we might say God is patient or Jesus is patient. And so that kind of sometimes helps us move beyond the abstract because we can read the word and say, oh, it's kind, it's patient, it does not envy, it does not boast. But as we start to think about it, love is action. Love is specific acts and specific deeds. And so we have to think about what might that look like. And so we can think about what that is. Or another way to do it is just read through the letter of Corinthians. If you were to go back about some of the things that Paul talks about in the church in Corinth and how what they are doing does not look like what love is. So I'm going to offer you a few examples here. So love is patient. Jesus waits patiently. If you know the stories of Jesus with his disciples, he spends 3 years with these, particularly his 12 closest to him, but other many numerous disciples, and he spends time with them. And even on the very last days he is with them, they don't understand what he's doing. But how do we see Jesus responding to them? In fact, after his death and resurrection, one of his followers who's denied him, he comes to him, and he doesn't say, you screwed it up, Peter. Instead, he shows love to him. Love waits patiently. Or we can think of, if we want to go back to our Old Testament stories, and God's patience with the people of Israel. He brings this people out of slavery in Egypt, and he brings them to a mountain, and the first thing they do is make an idol. And then they get in the desert, and they grumble. And time after time after time again, they turn away from him. But God waits patiently and returns to them. Jesus shows, or love is kind, Jesus shows acts of kindness. The stories we read about Jesus stopping for a man who's blind. He turns aside for a group of people who have a skin disease. He carries on a conversation with a woman at a well. He shows kindness that's pure and unselfish, a concern for the well-being of others. This is love does not envy. Well, if we were to go back in 1 Corinthians chapter 3, verse 3, it says, "You are still worldly, since there is jealousy and quarreling and envy among you." So he's talking about they're experiencing this, and he's reminding them that love doesn't envy. Love doesn't desire something else. He says, "Love is not proud or infatuated." Chapter 8, verse 1, where he talks about this very thing. He says, we all possess knowledge, but knowledge puffs up. And I think that's a great way of not being proud, is this sense of importance where we inflate ourselves. And I was thinking of the story, Aesop's fables, of the story of the ox and the frog. I don't know if you're familiar with the story. So in the story of the ox and the frog, this little frog comes to Father Frog and says, "Father, Father, I saw this beast as immense as a mountain. It had giant horns and its hooves were split over in the field." And Father Frog looks at the little frog and he says, "Oh, that was just Farmer White's ox. He's not so big." And the little frog says, "Oh, he was huge." And Father Frog says, "No, watch, I can be as big as that." And the frog starts to, and he takes in a big breath and starts to inflate himself. And the little frog says, no, he was much bigger than that. And the Father Frog inflates himself a little bit more. And the little frog says, no, he was much bigger than that. And Father Frog inflates himself a little bit bigger. And the little frog says, almost. And Father Frog inflates himself a little bit more. And Father Frog says, "Is that it?" And the little frog says, "Yes." And at that point, Father Frog explodes. And that's the sense of inflation with self, where love is, where it says it does not boast. It's that sense of inflating self, where it's pumping air into yourself and making yourself look bigger and more important than you want. It's about intention to self. And then it goes on, it says it does not dishonor others. In other words, what does it show? Love, what does love do? It shows respect. It shows courtesy. Love is not self-seeking. In other words, it's the opposite of self-interest and self-centeredness. We go back to Jesus, and I know I've referenced this a number of times, but in Philippians chapter 2, where Paul has this incredible thing where he talks about the love of Jesus, what it looks like. He says, "For Jesus did not consider equality with God something to be held on to, but instead took the form of a servant and died on a cross." And so it's this way of saying that Jesus did not think about himself, but he thought about others. It's not self-centered. Love is not easily angered. We might translate that as simply, it doesn't overreact. Love isn't touchy. It doesn't take every little offense and build it into something great. Love keeps no record of wrongs. We know how easy that is to do. To count up all the little wrongs, all the little ways someone has stepped over a line, all the little ways somebody has hurt us, and we just kind of keeping the little tabs on the wall. And we start to brood on them and add them all up until there's this giant total. And what eventually happens with that? It comes out. But it says love doesn't keep a record of wrongs. Now I realize this passage here, it's not a full theology of love or a practical handbook for relationships. But what it is an account of love so that we can say this is what it's about. And how we can lead a life of love. Because even if we start to make it a full account, if we try and make it and say, "Oh, well, but you didn't say this about love," see how that leads down a wrong path? We might be reading this and say, "Well, aren't there times it's okay to be angry? Jesus got angry." And all of a sudden, we're making excuses for ourselves. But here he's saying, this is the picture of what love looks like and when it's used correctly. And what's Paul focusing on? He's focusing on a community that is characterized by love. And what love looks like. He's providing pictures and practices for a community so they can live out their calling. And I think it's the same for us. These are words that as we think through them, as we meditate on them, we can begin to practice and live out our calling as we exercise our gifts, as we interact with one another, as we serve our community, as we sit in Bible studies together, as we have coffee with one another, as we spend time with our family. These are ways we can live out what it looks like to love. It goes on, he says, it does not delight in evil. And that can take different forms. It can look at the rejoicing at failings of others. Or back in 1 Corinthians again. Earlier in the letter, there was this point where there were people, there was a man who was with his mom, his stepmom. And so there's this issue of they were tolerating that. And so love does not delight in evil. It doesn't join in the arrogance of tolerating sins. In other words, love doesn't overlook the sins. And it also doesn't thrill at being able to lecture people on their shortcomings. It rejoices in the truth. And I think here's the sense of it's not interested in spin or self-promotion, which is a currency of today where we want to lift ourselves. Love rejoices in what's true. And if we want to break it down in sense, there's two parts to love. Love does not seek its own advantage, but instead it seeks the good of the other. And then he goes on, it's not just something in certain circumstances, but it says it always protects, always trusts, always hopes, always perseveres. It's a constant thing. And then he finishes with reflection on the permanence of love. Love never fails. But where there are prophecies, they will cease. Where there are tongues, they will be stilled. Where there is knowledge, it will pass away. For we know in part and we prophesy in part. But when completeness comes, what is in part disappears. When I was a child, I talked like a child. I thought like a child. I reasoned like a child. When I became a man, I put away the ways of childhood behind me. For now we only see as a reflection in a mirror. Then we shall see face to face. Now I know in part, then I shall know fully, even as I am fully known. And now these three remain, faith, hope, and love. But the greatest of these is love. What does he say? These gifts like tongues, knowledge, prophecies will be brought to nothing. Why? Because they only provide a partial knowledge of God. God knows us fully now. He said, we'll know him fully in the end. And what's the path, the connection between where we are now and knowing God fully in the end? Love. Why? Because God is love. And so as we love, we participate in his life. We're transformed to become like him. We join in his life of love. So as we're exercising love, as we're acting out love, as we're loving others now, we're growing closer to God, and we're growing closer to that experience we will have when we see God face to face. Our love here and now is a dark vision. It's a dim, it's a poor reflection, but it's a reflection nonetheless. And so the picture is of ancient mirrors. They didn't have polished glass. Sometimes it was just brass or whatever. And so you looked in the mirror, and if you've ever done that, maybe you looked in a piece of steel or something. You can see yourself, right? But it's not a clear picture, but it's a picture nonetheless. And so he's saying when we're loving, we're beginning to see that picture. The gifts and the prophecies, they see it a little bit, but the way we truly see who God is, the way we truly experience God, the way we truly participate in the life of God is through love. As we allow the Spirit to display God's love in and through us. And the kind of love is the love of God we see most fully displayed on the cross. As we open ourselves to the work of the Spirit in and through us, we are transformed and we are brought closer to the time where we will see him as we are known. So what I want to do as we close our time together is I'm going to go back to that middle section, that description of love, and I'm going to read through it slowly. And what I'm going to invite you to do is to ask the Spirit where he is inviting you to grow. I don't want this to be a time of self-flagellation or beating yourself up and realizing, like, oh, I don't do that very well. Or what we might be more tendency to do, like, he doesn't do that very well, and I know she doesn't do that very well. But I want it to be a time of listening to the Spirit. And what I want you to do is maybe notice one word or phrase, because I believe God wants us to be, this is deep down, God wants us to be more loving. God isn't in the place of saying, come on, you can do it, you can do it. But God genuinely wants us to be more loving. He wants us to be more like Jesus, and he will show us where we need to grow, and he'll help us grow. So what I want you to do is notice if there's one of those phrases, just pick one. One of those phrases that stands out to you or where you feel the Spirit speaking to you, where you think God is inviting you to let his love grow you. As you're reading through saying, oh, that one, I feel like the Spirit's calling me into that. And maybe you recall an event from earlier this week or last month or maybe even this morning where you think, ah, that doesn't look like what love looks like. And so you're going to invite then the Spirit to help you to see that and to see how you can grow in that place. And so as I read this, I want you to help open yourself to the Spirit and say, God, which one of these are you calling me to grow in? In which one of these areas do I need more of your love? In which one of these areas do I need your help to look more like Jesus? In which one of these areas do I need to grow in love? So let's hear his word again. Love is patient. Love is kind. It does not envy. It does not boast. It is not proud. It does not dishonor others. It is not self-seeking. It is not easily angered. It keeps no record of wrongs. Love does not delight in evil. It rejoices with the truth. It always protects, always trusts, always hopes, always perseveres. God, you are love. You have showed us what love looks like in your Son Jesus and his death on the cross. We are called to love because you first loved us. We can only love through your love. So, our God, during this week, as we consider the picture of love that you have given us through Paul, may your Spirit work in and through us so we can show the same love to others that you have shown us. Amen.